The Day the World Ended at Little Bighorn, a Lakota History by Joseph M. Marshall III. Chapter 8. Zuyawi Chasha, the Warriors. A warrior I have been. I have had a hard time. Sitting Bull, Hunkpapa Lakota. Lakota males were bred to fulfill two broad societal roles simultaneously, the hunter-warrior or the provider-protector. These duties were not performed, however, to the exclusion or diminishment of other roles and responsibilities. Furthermore, contrary to long-held beliefs, the Lakota male did not live for war. The word warrior has long been associated with the native North American males, especially of the Plains tribes. Other labels commonly used are tribesmen, braves, or the ever-popular hostiles. Being a warrior was a necessary and critical societal role. It was the predominant one. For many tribes like the Lakota, military service was not an obligation fulfilled with a tour of a few years, nor was it regarded as a job or a career. Rather, military service was a lifelong calling, fulfilled in conjunction with all the other responsibilities expected of males. The other critical responsibility was as the hunter. As a hunter, a man provided a living for his family and community. The equipment, skills, and abilities necessary for being both a hunter and warrior were interchangeable, most notably in the area of weaponry. Although some weapons were similar in appearance, there was a definite distinction in usage because the design and configuration of a hunting weapon differed from one used for war. For example, except when it was absolutely necessary, a bow used for hunting was not used in battle, and it was the same for arrows. In the case of lances, the lance used to hunt buffalo was often twice as long as a war lance, which was rarely longer than the height of its owner. On the other hand, some weapons were meant only for hunting, such as the throwing stick, also called a rabbit stick, used to bring down small game, and the sling for throwing stones, also used for small game. Likewise, war clubs were used only in combat. Firearms became the preferred weapons, especially for warfare, when they came on the scene. But there was more to the hunter-warrior than his weapons. He was trained to be at home in the natural environment, in any terrain, and in any weather in all seasons of the year. From about the age of 5, boys were taught the skills necessary to be hunters and warriors, such as tracking, handcrafting tools and weapons, close combat, proficiency with weapons and horsemanship. They were mentored one-on-one by older males, fathers, uncles, grandfathers, family, friends, until about the age of 16 or 17. They were taken on hunts and military expeditions to observe experienced full-fledged hunters and fighting in the field. By their late teens, Lakota males were ready to fulfill their roles and take their places as hunters and warriors. The gender role philosophy of Lakota culture and its practical application enabled the availability of a ready fighting force. A man never stopped being a warrior, although that role shifted around the age of 50. Then a man no longer had the physical capabilities of younger men. So while the younger men took to the field on raids and scouting missions, older men stayed in camp as the first line of defense for the women, children, and elderly. Furthermore, every fighting man was taught that his commitment as the warrior ended only with death, whether it came on the field of battle or with old age. Dying in the defense of family and home, however, was the highest of honors and the strongest legacy to leave behind. It was this kind of fighting man that the 7th Cavalry faced in the Valley of the Little Bighorn. The six-legged warrior. One of the biggest factors in the Lakota victory at the Battle of the Little Bighorn was the horse. It was often said that a Lakota male had six legs, two of his own and the four belonging to his horse. This, of course, speaks to the way the horse so readily became part of the nomadic hunting lifestyle of the Plains peoples. All native societies eventually acquired the horse, but their basic culture and lifestyle did not change. Rather, the nomadic peoples of the Plains became even more nomadic. The horse did not motivate the people to move over the land. It did, however, greatly increase their mobility. Just as important, it gave the Lakota fighting man another dimension as a warrior. He became a mounted warrior. Initially, the horse displaced the dog as beast of burden. He was much, much larger and stronger, and therefore the loads he carried were larger. Shunka Waka was the label applied by the Lakota to this new and wonderful creature, Shunka being the word for dog. The label had been translated as sacred dog and holy dog, which are essentially appropriate descriptors. But for Waka, there is no suitable word in English. Lakota linguists do not agree on the best translations to English. Holy and sacred are close, but Waka can also mean powerful, beyond, or greater than. For example, if a man or a woman did something extraordinary or beyond the norm, it would be described as a powerful act that would be Waka Wo'echu. Therefore, the Lakota label for the horse accurately described it in two ways. First, it was obviously far greater than the dog, and second, its contribution to the Lakota society was beyond measure. With the horse, the Lakota expanded their population and their territories, and they fielded some of the best light cavalry the world has ever known. The war horses that Lakota fighting men rode into battle were picked for their temperament, endurance, and agility. They were schooled for years to respond to the rider's cues of weight, shift, leg pressure, and voice. And like the warrior himself, the horse that had experienced combat was a thoroughly valuable asset. Many Lakota warriors had more than one, and sometimes they had one or two more in the process of being trained. At dawn on the 25th of June, scouts of the 7th Cavalry were training their field glasses to the west from a high knoll called the Crow's Nest. They saw no dwellings, only something on the floodplain west of the Little Bighorn River that resembled maggots in the grass. They saw horses, thousands of them, grazing peacefully on that fateful morning were the horses that formed one of the single largest herds to occupy one area. Horses that belonged to the thousand or so families that were part of the Little Bighorn encampment of Lakota and Northern Cheyenne. Many were travois horses that pulled drag poles to transport household belongings and people that could no longer ride. Many of these were big American horses taken on raids. There were everyday riding horses owned by each family, those belonging to boys and young men, the hunter warriors in training, and more than a few war horses. On the average, each family owned 10 to 15 horses. These were the maggots in the grass, a herd probably of between 12,000 to 15,000 head. Without a doubt, the scouts knew that the horses in the valley of the Little Bighorn meant the presence of many, many people. They also knew that inside the encampment, what they could not see were the six-legged warriors, the fighting men, and their war horses. Customarily, the best and most valuable war horses were picketed at their owner's lodge door, a safeguard against theft from any enemy raiders. The six-legged warrior was the single most important factor in the defeat of the soldiers at the Little Bighorn. Boys, as well as many girls, were put on a horse at the age of 4 or 5. By the time they were 12, they were more than adequate riders, and by the age of 16, they had reached the level of expert. At that point, riding a horse was second nature. The basics of riding had become rather like breathing or blinking. They were done without conscious thought. The fighting man and his horse had an emotional bond that was an intangible and fearsome weapon. When an expert rider is paired with an extremely well-trained horse, the result is a formidable instrument of warfare. Major Reno's soldiers learned that firsthand. Relentless charges by Lakota horsemen broke the soldiers' skirmish line and turned Reno's attack into a Lakota rout. The second engagement of the battle began with the pursuit of Custer's 5 companies up the slope away from Medicine Tail Coulee, or Dry Creek. Gall led his men across the river and charged after the fleeing soldiers. That engagement ended at Last Stand Hill after a relentless chase. Part of the reason for this outcome was the 7th Cavalry's worn-out horses and the fresher mounts of the Lakota and Northern Cheyenne. But the larger reason was the skill and daring of the six-legged warriors. In a heartbeat. In the 1950s and 1960s, Lakota and Cheyenne schoolchildren were taught the story of the colonial Minutemen. They were ordinary men who farmed and followed other pursuits of the day, but they also kept their muskets and powder horns at hand in order to respond at a minute's notice to the ever-present threat from the British Army. Native societies across North America had invented this strategy long before the American colonies were established. Non-Indian teachers who extolled the courage of the Minutemen probably did not realize that the Lakota children in their classrooms learning about the American Revolution were 2 and 3 generations removed from ancestors who had employed this tactic in their fight for freedom. Every day, except in extremely inclement weather, in every encampment, large or small, during any season of the year, near the lodge doors were reassuring reminders of the strength of the community. On a tripod of willows to the left or right of the door were attached the weapons and accoutrements of the warrior or warriors who lived in the lodge. If the tripod was bare, it meant that the warrior was away. Weapons and accoutrements arranged in such a manner were practical as well as symbolic. When the fighting man was at home in the encampment, he knew where his weapons were and could grab them in an instant if necessary. Such a display also demonstrated that the fighting men of the community were ready to rise to the defense of the people in a heartbeat. Nothing succeeds like success. The soldiers who attacked the encampment on the Little Bighorn were unaware that 8 days earlier, several hundred Lakota fighting men and their Northern Cheyenne allies had stopped General George Crook's northern advance 50 miles to the south. As a matter of fact, they had carried the fight to Crook at Rosebud Creek, just north of the present town of Sheridan, Wyoming. In a real sense, the Battle of the Little Bighorn and the Battle of the Rosebud were two separate events, but the outcome at the Rosebud bolstered the confidence of the Lakota and Northern Cheyenne, not to mention that it also provided valuable experience. Yet the Battle of the Rosebud is rarely considered a factor in the outcome of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. When the first shots opened the Rosebud Battle at dawn on the 17th of June, Crook's soldiers and their Crow and Shoshone allies were waking from a night's rest. For their part, the attacking force led by Crazy Horse had just completed a 50-mile ride in the dark. Without any rest, they engaged the enemy in a battle that ended in the late afternoon. When Crazy Horse decided to withdraw his fighters from the field, Crook did not have the means to stop him. Subsequently, the Lakota and Northern Cheyenne rode the 50 miles back to their encampment, which was near Ash Creek at the time, arriving at dawn after nearly 36 hours without significant rest. Crazy Horse and his battlefield leaders and fighting men had engaged a numerically superior force that had more guns and ammunition. For all intents and purposes, the battle was probably a draw, but because Crook could do no more than lick his wounds and withdraw to the south, the Lakota considered it a victory. What they did not know was that they had effectively dismantled the U.S. Army's grand plan to catch them in a trap. Crook had been one-third of that plan. 8 days later, they spoiled the trap entirely after Lieutenant Colonel George Custer ordered the 7th to attack prematurely, as it turns out. Little Bighorn still would have been a victory for the Lakota if Rosebud had not occurred, simply because there were too many factors in their favor. But confidence bolstered by the outcome at Rosebud Creek was an immeasurable advantage. When Lakota fighting men realized that the Little Bighorn encampment was under a full-scale attack, many of them thought it was the soldiers from the Rosebud fight seeking revenge. A recurring thought must have gone through many of their minds. We did it once, and we can do it again. A vision fulfilled. A few short weeks before the Battle of the Rosebud, while the people were still encamped along Ash Creek, Sitting Bull had conducted a sundance and had been given a vision. He had seen soldiers and their horses falling from the sky, their ears cut off. They were falling into a circle of Lakota lodges. Soldiers falling into camp became a prediction of victory, and many were quick to say that Sitting Bull's vision had been fulfilled at the Rosebud. But many elders were just as quick to disagree because Crazy Horse had carried the battle to the soldiers. There were those who felt strongly that the Hunkpapa holy man's vision had yet to be realized. And in the first moments when gunfire blasted the stillness of a lazy afternoon on the 25th of June, many people were filled with apprehension when it became apparent that an attack was underway. But at the same time, many remembered Sitting Bull's vision, even as they prepared for battle or grabbed their children and elderly to flee from the soldiers. Sitting Bull himself exhorted warriors to have courage and remember the helpless ones, but not because he was uncertain of the outcome of the developing battle. He shouted encouragement because he knew that the courage of warriors was key to fulfilling his vision. Sitting Bull was at the height of his influence and power as a holy man. He had been a formidable warrior in his younger days and had won nearly 70 war honors. For that record of achievement, he had the respect of every fighting man in the encampment. To them, his vision was a guarantee of victory. No one was foolish enough to think that fighting the soldiers would be easy. The threat had to be confronted, and so it was. No one had to remind any fighting man of the dire consequences if the soldiers were to gain the advantage. It was common knowledge that soldiers killed and mutilated women and children, but they were also the symbol and the instrument of white invasion into Lakota lands and life. Everything that every fighting man held near and dear was in that encampment, and every man was willing to lay down his life to defend it. Early in the first attack, the Valley Fight, Sitting Bull's vision literally came true. Before Major Reno dismounted his men and formed a skirmish line, at least two, perhaps three, soldiers were carried into the encampment by their mounts. The horses, probably frightened and confused by the chaos and gunfire, could not be controlled. Inside the camp, the soldiers were caught and pulled down and killed. After the last engagement of the day ended and the warriors heard of the incident, many were not surprised. That incident was an affirmation of the power of Sitting Bull's vision. Some say that the Lakota fighting man had his finest day at the Little Bighorn, but such an opinion is often expressed without full knowledge of the conflicts faced by the Lakota. Many of the Little Bighorn warriors were at least 35 years of age and had seen considerable fighting. There had been at least five major battles against the U.S. Army during the 1860s, not to mention the fighting along the Bozeman Trail against white civilians. Furthermore, many had fought against the Crow and the Shoshone, long-standing and staunch enemies. Most of those who fought at Little Bighorn would likely agree that the three engagements over 2 days of fighting were some of the hardest fighting they had experienced. But not all would agree that it was their finest day, based partially on their opinions of their opponents. To some fighting men, soldiers were not honorable enemies. To defeat them was necessary, to be sure. If any man felt that the victory there was a fine achievement, that feeling was primarily because the warriors had successfully defended the people. And that, after all was said and done, was what a Lakota warrior was committed to doing. The Lakota fighters who rose to meet the enemy that day on the Little Bighorn, the Greasy Grass to them, were ordinary men. They were husbands, fathers, sons, grandsons, and grandfathers. They would still be heroes to us, the Lakota of today, even if they had lost the battle. They are heroes because they defended their own. By doing so, they did what men in any culture or society have done throughout the ages. They were not supermen, but pound for pound, they were better trained and more highly skilled as fighters than the soldiers they faced that day. The Lakota words for warrior are Zuya Wichasha, literally meaning war man, but also translated as man who goes to war. Zuya means war, and Wichasha means man. During each generation, many Lakota families passed down the story of ancestors who fought at the Little Bighorn. Though they did not live for war, neither did they turn away from it. Their legacy as warriors will live on, therefore, as reminders, as examples, and as inspiration. Those fighting men, those real warriors, will always be heroes. Join us again next week for the reading of
Chapter 9.
This program is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.